Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation.
Jeffrey North is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where he serves as chair of the MA degree program in Nonproliferation and Terrorism Studies. Dr. North is also a research affiliate with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at Monterey and with the Center on International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Professor North received a PhD in political science from Stanford, and he has previously taught at the University of Southern California, the University of California in Santa Cruz, and the Naval Postgraduate School. He has published extensively on arms control, nonproliferation, deterrence, and security assurances. Among his most recent publications, he is a co-editor of Behavioral Economics and Nuclear Weapons, as well as many others. Professor North, Jeffrey, if I may, thank you for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We're delighted that you could make the time to talk to us. I want us to get started by referring to a recent paper of yours, which I had the pleasure to read, on the psychological and societal sources of nuclear peace, where you point out that the world has managed to maintain nuclear peace for close to 78 years following the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States in 1945. For the benefit of our listeners, can you summarize for us some of the factors that contributed to this nuclear peace, and why you think that they still fall short of providing a comprehensive explanation?
Yes, I'd be pleased to. Thank you, Augusto, very much for inviting me onto this podcast. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You know, in some ways, it's a miracle that we're here to have this conversation. If you spoke to observers in the late 1940s, early 1950s, most of them would have been convinced that it was just a matter of time until we would have a World War III, right? And it would be nuclear, and it would be, you know, as the usual jargon has it, an apocalypse, Armageddon, you know, something really that we probably, I think, can't even imagine. The death and destruction that would follow from that. So the fact that we've now gone more than 75 years since the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and nuclear weapons have not been used again for purposes of military attack or a terrorist attack or by accident, you know, is a remarkable achievement in its way for the human race. And it you know, raises some very big questions, right? How did we get here? How have we managed to avoid Armageddon for so long? But just as important, you know, how long will it last, right? Are the things which have seemed to keep us safe, you know, what is the likelihood that these will continue into the future? So people have proposed quite a number of possible explanations for the so-called nuclear peace. And I think all of them capture part of the truth, right? It's not that they're wrong, but to me, all of them are also insufficient, right? None of them is strong enough to offer a 100% guarantee that the worst couldn't happen. So in the paper that you mentioned, I'm sort of interested in what we can do to sort of reinforce the guardrails that people usually talk about. So I'll quickly sort of identify five things that people talk about, and then we can sort of talk about why they may not be sufficient. You know, most people usually point to the power of nuclear deterrence, right? Once two countries and then more countries had nuclear weapons, anybody who used them might face nuclear retaliation, and that's pretty sobering. So that creates a lot of inhibitions, though for reasons we can talk about. I think that nuclear deterrence is not foolproof, and it could still fail. Some people are a little more cynical, and they say, actually, there's really no military utility for nuclear weapons, and the reason we haven't used them is they're not useful. They're too big and destructive and indiscriminate to be valuable as a sort of tactical, you know, battlefield warfighting weapon. I think there's some merit to that as well, but also it's not 100% accurate. A lot of people highlight the power of norms and a so-called nuclear taboo, that from earlier in the nuclear age, there's been a sense that you just don't use these weapons. And I do think some elements of a norm exist, but again, it's probably not as strong as a sort of full-fledged taboo as that vocabulary would have it. Some people say we've just been lucky. And I think there's actually a lot of merit to that, right? If you look at nuclear history since 1945, there's been a lot of close calls where it's not hard to imagine that things really could have gone the other way, right? And if luck is really random, right, it's a coin flip, you know, the next time we're in a close call, there's a 50-50 chance that we won't be so lucky next time. So it seems really crazy to depend on luck to hold forever. And then, you know, I think of particular interest to you, Augusto, and your listeners, right? There are international institutions, right? So there's a whole architecture that was developed over time, arms control, non-proliferation, export controls, you know, various treaties and international organizations that have also tried to kind of restrain the use of nuclear weapons. And to me, these have also been a remarkable achievement. But they're not 100% effective. And so there's many things we can identify that help reduce the dangers of nuclear war, and they're all important, and they all need to be maintained. But if we were to do a deep dive and analyze each of those things, you know, we could also identify flaws, reasons why they are not 100% reliable. And so in addition to trying to maintain and strengthen these things, it's important to think about other sources of restraint, other guardrails that we could put in place. And final thought on this question, I think many of the things I've just mentioned are getting weaker. Right? Just earlier this week, Russia announced that it's suspending its participation in the New START arms control treaty. And that was the last nuclear arms control treaty that was in effect between the United States and Russia. So the whole arms control apparatus, you know, seems to be unraveling. The non-proliferation regime is weaker now than it used to be. There's many countries and leaders who talk in ways that seem to, you know, not respect the nuclear taboo. So some of these external guardrails, external restraints that the world has built up over time seem to me to be eroding and maybe even in danger of collapse. You know, and so because of that, I've started thinking about what are some of the other things we can do to encourage leaders, militaries, publics around the world to want to be careful around nuclear weapons and to want to minimize any actions that would bring us closer to the brink, right? And some of that may be internal, right? How do we think about nuclear weapons? How do we feel about nuclear weapons? How much do we know about what a nuclear war would mean? How much are we aware of the different dangers that could lead to the different scenarios that could lead to nuclear escalation? And what can we do to encourage people to internally, in their own thinking and feeling and decision processes, practice self-restraint and caution and prudence and not want to do things that would bring us closer to nuclear war? So that's kind of where I've been going in the project that I'm working on with you.
Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. That's a very insightful overview. When discussing the sort of underlying conditions necessary for deterrence or for a nuclear taboo to reduce the chances of nuclear war, you focus on two concepts, fear and hope. And you make the point that I thought was particularly interesting, which is that the idea of fear is only helpful in a certain dose, since excessive fear can lead to paralysis and and actually exasperate or make worse, conditions that might be dangerous already. Can you expand on this idea of what we might call healthy fear of nuclear war? And would you say that that's the condition which characterizes the state of relations today between nuclear states, especially in light of what's happening in Ukraine?
Yes, so maybe I'll give a short answer to the second part of your question first, and then go back and elaborate a little bit. So the answer to is that the state of the world today is no, or at least not as much as it used to be, and not as much as it needs to be. It seems to me that we have many leaders in the world today who talk and act in ways that suggest they are not as afraid of the risk of nuclear war as I think ideally we would like them to be. It's been a very long time since the world experienced things that I think really put awareness of nuclear dangers into the forefront. You know, for the United States and Russia, the last really big, scary nuclear crisis was the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And that's more than 60 years ago. So Joe Biden's pretty old, so he at least was sort of alive at the time, and old enough to kind of, I think, remember that. But most generations of leaders around the world, you know, they don't have any firsthand experience of this kind of scary crisis, and it's a distant memory. And so there hasn't been other things to remind them recently of the risks they might take. I was born in 1960, so I grew up in my childhood in the 1960s, 1970s. There was quite a lot of popular culture that referenced, nuclear war, wonderful, terrifying movies like Dr. Strangelove or Failsafe or On the Beach, a lot of post-apocalyptic science fiction novels. So I'm part of a generation that grew up with constant reminders of what would happen if there was a nuclear war, of different kinds of scenarios that could lead to, this kind of worldwide catastrophe. But that hasn't been as true for many years now. So you have generations that have grown up and in some cases come to power that I think don't have that deep familiarity with thinking about thinking about the unthinkable, as the title of an old book had it. So when you think about some of the things I mentioned before, being deterred because of fear of nuclear retaliation, viewing the use of nuclear weapons as taboo, wanting to behave very, very carefully in a crisis because you fear bad luck and you fear going over the brink, right? There are what we could call psychological states that lie behind those explanations, right? If you are deterred because of fear of nuclear retaliation, right? That word fear, right, appears right in that explanation, right? It's doing work, right? You have to have an idea of what happens if nuclear weapons are detonated, what happens if a bunch of them go off, what would be the destruction to your own country, what would be the larger impact on the world, possibly triggering a nuclear winter or other kinds of catastrophic climactic changes, right? And you have to have some fear of or some appreciation of Murphy's Law, right? The things that can go wrong, the difficulty that human beings have to maintain complete control, complete mastery over events. And that's not automatic, right? We're not born as human beings with an instinct to fear nuclear weapons, right? They weren't part of the human evolutionary process. So there is a degree of learning that has to happen, right? That nuclear weapons exist, that they have these particularly unique and devastating effects, that if they are used, this is the kind of damage you would expect. So there's some knowledge that people have to gain and become aware of, right? And when people gain and become aware of that knowledge of the consequences of nuclear use and the kinds of scenarios where things could go wrong and increase the risk of nuclear escalation, we also want people ideally to react to that knowledge in a certain way, right? We want them to react to that knowledge in a way that inhibits them from certain kinds of risk-taking, right? That in the face of the existence of nuclear weapons and the danger of nuclear war, leaders, their advisors, their military brass, hopefully would want to act with caution and restraint, right, and not do things that push the world closer to the brink. So fear is fear, we can think of it as both a sort of cognitive and an emotional factor, right? It's partly a belief. There's danger ahead, and danger ahead means that I should be careful. But it's also an emotion, right? I'm afraid of what might happen. My pulse races. I start to sweat. I get freaked out. And that also hopefully, triggers some instincts that make us want to tread carefully and be really cautious. So I think we assume fear in a lot of our existing explanations for nuclear peace, but fear is not automatic. So we need to think about what are the ways in which we can encourage key people to have the right feelings of fear. And as you mentioned, I think this is a little bit of a Goldilocks problem, right? You could have both too much or too little. So in my mind, the problem is that the world is trending towards too little fear, and we need to kind of revive awareness of nuclear dangers and the desirability of being prudent to avoid actions that take us closer to the brink of nuclear war. But there is good research in the field of psychology that suggests that when fear gets very high, it has negative consequences for the quality of decision making, right? And so it can cause paralysis. That people are afraid to do anything because they're so overwhelmed by fear that they're no longer capable of thinking and acting, and they just sort of retreat into a shell, right? And if you're in a crisis that requires sort of managing the crisis dynamics, you don't want your leaders paralyzed. Fear can also cause sort of hasty and panicky reactions where people make bad decisions because they just want to do something quickly to try to change the situation. And so I don't have a good answer for sort of what's the right place to calibrate this, what's exactly the right level of fear, but there's some sweet spot in the middle where it's neither too high or too low. And I like to refer to that as a healthy level of fear, enough to make you cautious without degrading the quality of decision-making so that people make bad decisions.
Let me shift gears a little bit, Jeff. Thank you. In your analysis of the shortcomings of common explanations for nuclear peace, you highlight that some leaders, particularly autocratic ones, cannot be assumed to view themselves as being constrained by international norms. I'm thinking, North Korea, for instance, or perhaps more importantly, China and Russia, where perhaps their leaders might think that losing power might be a worse outcome for them than threatening the use or actually using nuclear weapons in defense of some kind of strategic interest. In other words, in an age in which we have seen a resurgence of authoritarian strongmen, right? Actors that are not necessarily motivated by ethical norms and for whom maintaining power is perhaps the overriding concern, right? Are the barriers to the use of nuclear weapons perhaps not so applicable anymore?
I think they're still applicable, Augusto, but weakened. So in the paper that you referenced, I think my analysis was perhaps a little one-sided in focusing so much on the risks of authoritarian leaders. So I should start with a caveat that democratic leaders are also capable of norm-defying behavior. We saw, for example, in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, that the George W. Bush administration decided that they required actions on the part of the United States that were probably not so consistent with international law or prevailing norms, such as capturing people and parking them away in a prison in Guantanamo on the island of Cuba with no normal, due process rights. And at the nuclear level, the nuclear posture review that the Bush administration developed, you know, talked about possibly the United States would have to be the first to use nuclear weapons to preempt certain kinds of threats that were not nuclear, but were seen as being particularly bad, maybe a chemical or biological attack by another country or a country that was hosting a terrorist organization that was willing to use WMD. So even in democracies, the norms are sometimes discounted or ignored. But I do think the problem is even more severe in some autocratic regimes for a couple of reasons. It's the ways in which leaders come to power, the nature of exercising power in those countries typically already requires, as your term strongman kind of indicated, you know, typically already requires having a fairly coercive orientation towards the world. So it's a different style of coming to power than in a democracy where you have to sort of appeal to the public and win popular approval and maybe be willing to compromise and negotiate. So you're getting people whose life lessons and maybe their personality types already predispose them to reach for coercive tools when they encounter a problem. But also it's very hard to hold them accountable domestically, right? Their rule is close to absolute, right? And if it were to collapse, it's going to collapse sort of suddenly and all at once. And for most dictators, that's their worst fear, right? They in many ways care less about national security for their country as a whole, right? And they care more about personal survival, regime security. Can they keep their rule? Can they keep their regime in power? And in situations where they fear the possibility of being overthrown internally, that can really change their decision calculus and make them willing to do really risky and dangerous things to, you know, in a last ditch gamble to keep themselves in office. So let me give you an example that involves chemical weapons, you know, rather than nuclear weapons. Right in Syria, you know, a little over a decade ago, there was a large rebellion that rose up against the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. He fought back against it with very violent means, triggering what became a big civil war in Syria, still not, you know, fully settled today. Syria possessed a pretty large arsenal of chemical weapons at the time that everybody understood was kind of meant as a strategic deterrent against Israel's nuclear arsenal, and people did not think that Assad would ever use those weapons internally against his own people. But if you look at the ebb and flow of the civil war, at moments when Assad's forces were on the back foot and he was in danger of using, they carried out what ended up being, you know, dozens or maybe even hundreds of chemical attacks, including a few that used nerve agents and caused, you know, large numbers of casualties. So, you know, there's a taboo against chemical weapons use just as much as there is against nuclear use. But when a dictator fears losing power, all those norms go out the window and they become willing to do quite extreme things if they think that gamble would help them stay in power. So I do worry about the Kim Jong-un's and Vladimir Putin's of the world. You know, what happens if they really truly see that their backs are up against the wall or believe that their backs are up against the wall? Would that erode the remaining restraints in their minds against attempting nuclear use?
Let's follow up a little bit on this Vladimir Putin angle to this question. As you know, he has not been shy about threatening the use of its nuclear arsenal in Ukraine. In fact, to quote him, he said, he will use all available means to protect Russia and our people. And he further added, this is not a bluff, right? So many of the drivers of nuclear war that you cite in your paper, you know, seem very applicable today. And specifically, you say leaders who face defeat in war and losing political power at home might decide to go out in a blaze of glory that destroys both sides rather than suffer humiliation and removal from power. Those are your words. Now, of course, we know that Putin's war has not gone according to plan. So how do you see our current sort of predicament? You saw that a few weeks ago, the famous doomsday clock issued by the Bulletin of Nuclear Scientists set at 90 seconds before midnight. At some level, is this not terrifying, in fact?
So yes, absolutely, this is terrifying. That's correct. But I would say, all hope is not lost. We can think historically, it's been reported that, in the closing stages of World War II, Adolf Hitler would have preferred to see Germany destroyed completely rather than be defeated and him lose power. And fortunately, his top generals weren't willing to sort of follow that script, and Germany didn't have the means to sort of, cause Armageddon. But when you have leaders who personalize everything, they are the state, everything's about them and not their people, there is a risk that they could order, quite horrific things. The doomsday clock, Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists symbol, I think is a nice way to think about this. These are assessments of probability, right? So as long as nuclear weapons exist, there's some level of risk of nuclear weapons use, accident, nuclear war, right? There's good reasons why we can never get that down to zero. But most of the time, the risk is very low, right? At any given moment in time, the chance that something's going to happen that triggers a decision to launch nuclear weapons is fortunately very, very low, probably much less than 1%, right? But sometimes things happen which increase that risk level. I don't think there's any good way to put a precise mathematical formula on it, but we could sort of intuitively say, poll all the experts, what would you say is the probability that there'll be a nuclear weapon use in the next 6 months or in the next year? Russia's intervention in Ukraine and the course of that war, which has gone very badly for Russia, it increases the risk. I would still say the probability is pretty low, probably less than 10%. But, if in 2021, before the Ukraine war, I would have said the risk was less than 1%, saying today that it's less than 10%, that's a pretty big increase in the level of risk, and it moves us into a probability zone that, although I still think any nuclear weapon use resulting from Ukraine is quite unlikely, there's enough added risk right now to I think, justifiably make us all uncomfortable and to want to think about how can we lower the temperature and lower that risk again.
Jeffrey, let's talk about another concept that you introduce in your paper, which I think is very pertinent for these dangerous times, and that's the idea of hope. You propose that leaders, and I quote you, must hope that they can find a diplomatic solution that will let them avoid war. Now, coming to the present, we are in 2023. Rather than having two nuclear superpowers eager to avoid war, which was basically, the period of the Cold War, now we have nine countries who possess these weapons, all with different leaders, motivations, value systems, forms of governance. And it seems to me that the type of understanding that was reached, for instance, between President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis seems, sort of unlikely today, right? Because you have had this proliferation on the number of players. So the question then to you is, how do we foster this mentality of hope in a world where cooperation and understanding between powers is increasingly challenging and competition, peaceful or otherwise, for resources, for land, for people, for water, for food, seems to be the main characteristic of international relations?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me say a little bit about hope, right? And then I'll answer the question that you actually posed. So if we get very simple-minded about how do people make choices, right? We could boil it down like at any given moment, maybe you have two choices. I'm going to escalate up the nuclear ladder, or I'm not. Or maybe a third choice, I'm going to look desperately for some way to de-escalate. What would motivate you to make one choice or another, right? So one is the fear part, right? Fear of the negative consequences. If I move further down the escalatory ladder, I could find my own country destroyed. I could find the world destroyed. I could find human civilization essentially rendered impossible. That's scary. But you still need a second motivation to make a different choice, which is if I make a different choice, it could turn out better, right? If I show restraint, I'm not committing national suicide, right? If I try to de-escalate, this could work, right? So you need to have the hope that a peaceful outcome, that a better outcome remains a feasible possibility in order to let fear do its work and encourage decisions, incentivize decisions that steer people away from the brink. So the tough question here is, where does that hope come from? Right. Sometimes in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis and Kennedy and Khrushchev, I think it came from the fact that they had met. They had summit meetings. They knew each other. The relationship had been very testy and certainly not warm or good. But on some level, I think each one felt they knew the other one enough to believe that if they made a gesture with an olive branch, right, that it would be reciprocated, that the other side wouldn't try to seize upon it as something to take advantage of and not see it. They wouldn't see it as a sign of weakness. And I don't know how much you have that today among world leaders, right? I don't think Biden and Putin would have much trust in each other, or Biden and Xi Jinping in China. You know, one of the most interesting things that Donald Trump did when he was president was have a series of summit meetings with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, where bizarrely they seemed like they were in the early stages actually maybe developing a surprisingly good personal relationship, but that seems to have fallen apart by the end of the Trump time in office, and Biden has not been interested in repeating that particular exercise in diplomacy. So what might be alternative ways, right, to get there? We could look for forms of dialogue that countries are still willing to do. So is there some other subject that you could meet about that's not as contentious, that would at least allow people to develop, you know, personal relationships? Maybe we have meetings over climate change rather than nuclear issues or over trade. Maybe we look for multilateral settings where not all the chips are resting on does the bilateral relationship be good or not. So one of my colleagues at our Center for Nonproliferation Studies has suggested that it might be a good idea to revive what was called the Nuclear Security Summits, which was a series of meetings that took place under President Obama's administration that brought together about 50 countries at a time to talk about measures that would increase the protection of nuclear materials that could be used to make nuclear weapons, mainly to reduce the chances that a non-state actor, a terrorist group, could get their hands on those materials. And that was one where you had pretty good consensus among countries, because basically nobody wants terrorists to be able to make a nuclear bomb. So that wasn't an issue where you had people butting heads with each other. So maybe you revive the Nuclear Security Summit process and you get a lot of countries together. And in that interaction, you can then discuss nuclear dangers and what do we do about them. But the other thing I would say is that, of course, we do not have to and we shouldn't rely 100% on our leaders to figure this out for us, right? So there's, you know, the old saying that the war is too important to be left to the generals. Nuclear war is too important to be left to the politicians, Right. So there's lots of things that civil society actors can do and should do. And the more that we could find ways to get especially younger people interested and engaged on these issues and maybe revive some of the, you know, big social movements of the past that brought new attention to the dangers of nuclear war and advanced proposals for new ideas that might lessen dangers. You know, I think having actors outside of government speak up and proclaim their concern about nuclear dangers, coupled with their desire for, you know, practical action steps that could reduce those dangers, you know, that might also open up additional doorways for, you know, countries to think, you know, we have some responsibility to humanity and to future generations. You know, we should have trust in how young people envision their future and try to give them hope by taking actions that reciprocate their hope that they will still have a viable future. So I think, you know, on the hope side of the equation, I look a lot more at actors outside of governments, and I think this is a place where civil society has a big role to play.
In your article, you quote Anne Harrington's description of nuclear weapons as fetish objects, ways for, you know, leaders to show off their power and arouse feelings of national pride, you know, in the public. I recently moderated a panel in which Jody Williams said that they're also a symbol of masculinity, you know, in a world that is, as you know, largely dominated by men. I think that 89% of all the prime ministers and head of states in the world are actually men. In fact, Jody said that she remembered a French politician once telling him that without nuclear weapons, France would be nothing, which is perhaps an exaggeration. But still, you know, it sort of builds into this notion of, you know, symbols of power and masculinity. And as you know, China has been building up and modernizing its arsenal, aiming to match that of, I guess, ultimately, the, you know, Russia and the United States, so that their place on the global stage is reaffirmed in some kind of symbolic way. And so this basically, you know, leads me to the question, in today's world, you know, with rising nationalistic governments in the ascendancy, are we facing the risk of nuclear confrontation that Jonathan Schell and others warned us about?
Yes, yeah, so I think that's right. Many of your listeners may remember the very marvelous title of a book by Helen Caldicott, the longtime Australian anti-nuclear activist from many decades ago. She wrote a book called Missile Envy, where the title, you know, obviously was sort of a play on you know, male insecurity. You know, decisions that states and their leaders make, there's always a mixture of sort of, you know, rational, strategic calculation, emotions that people feel at the moment, but also symbolism. Symbolism is very important. And for some countries, they do look at nuclear weapons as a kind of status symbol, right? That being a nuclear armed power is for them synonymous with being a great power, with having a certain kind of status in the world. And that absolutely complicates things, right? It makes it harder to convince countries to move on to a path of disarmament if they feel that it's not just a rational calculation whether nuclear weapons make them more secure or less secure, but it's also sort of a part of their national identity. And as you get countries that have a very vocal and assertive brand of nationalism, which is on the rise in China, or who have leaders who present themselves to the world in a way where a certain kind of macho posturing is an important part of their public persona, like a Vladimir Putin, it's certainly possible that how they think about nuclear weapons gets, you know, rolled up in that larger kind of machismo sort of thing. And that probably increases the danger of people making nuclear threats or getting into confrontations or crises. And then it becomes an open question about, would that also make people reluctant to back down, or once they peer into the abyss, you know, would they sober up and calm down? And, you know, the best thing for the world is that we never get to that situation and we don't put that to the test. But if it happens, it's, I find it hard to predict which way it would go.
Jeff, since this podcast is essentially about global governance, I wanted to discuss with you how the global order around nuclear weapons could be strengthened or perhaps rebuilt, since, as you pointed out in one of the earlier answers, you know, the current system is quickly unraveling, right? In the final part of your paper, you argue that we should build agreements that emphasize the psychological and societal factors to nuclear peace, rather than what has been the practice so far, which is, you know, sort of placing limits on arms. In other words, you seem to be of the opinion that the best way to ensure nuclear peace is to prevent countries from using weapons rather than to prevent them from building them, which seems to have been the focus in recent decades. You know, why is that?
Yeah, so I believe in both, right? So as you introduced me at the beginning, right, I'm the chair of a master's degree program where our students get a degree in labeled nonproliferation and terrorism studies. So I wouldn't be in charge of this program if I wasn't a strong believer in nonproliferation as a goal. So it is very important to limit the spread of nuclear weapons and convince countries that don't have them not to build them. I think that's absolutely a key contributor to nuclear peace. The fewer countries that have the bomb, the fewer opportunities there are for something to go wrong. So this is sort of both and rather than either or, right? And in addition to that, you know, for countries that have them or allies of countries that have them, right, we want to convince them that they should never be used, right? What's sometimes referred to as the Reagan-Gorbachev statement, which they agreed to in the 1980s, and which was recently endorsed again by all five of the nuclear weapon states that are recognized as such by the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. A nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought. So my concern here is not any disagreement with the goals of arms control or nonproliferation. I'm a big advocate of both. But I just worry that so much of the institutional global governance structure that was built up, you know, starting in the 1950s, it's eroding, it's under threat, and it's hard to see. I would be hard pressed to propose a treaty negotiation that could take place today that I think would have a high chance of success, right? Whether it's a follow-on, you know, U.S.-Russia arms control agreement or a trilateral arms control agreement where we try to bring in China, a new regional nuclear weapon free zone, a new nonproliferation agreement. There's just too much geopolitical division and conflict in the world right now for me to be optimistic that you could build new international institutions through a formal treaty negotiation. It doesn't seem promising to me. So what I'm thinking of is not an alternative or a substitute for what we did in the past, but really what I'm thinking about is, what are the sort of more short-term stopgap measures, right? While we wait for the world to hopefully return to conditions in which institution building would become viable again and fruitful again, you know, how do we keep the dam from collapsing for now, right? How do we put the sort of finger in the dike and reinforce the existing institutions and reinforce the existing instincts to avoid doing things that create nuclear dangers. And so I'm thinking of the global governance piece in a way that's sort of very indirect and very instrumental. What might be some things that we could do that maybe they won't lead to a new treaty or a new international organization or a new formal agreement at the end. But just by running these processes, they would help build up, you know, what I've called healthy fear and elements of hope. So I mentioned the nuclear security summits earlier. Maybe trying to revive the nuclear security summits would be one way to get people to start talking together and finding areas of common ground. Another one that I'm a big fan of is the so-called humanitarian initiative. So about 13 years ago, in the context of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty review process, there was a group of countries that called for a series of meetings that was initially called the Humanitarian Consequences Initiative and then just the Humanitarian Initiative. This was modeled to some extent on the successful campaigns to ban landmines and ban cluster munitions. Let's have some meetings where we hear from the experts about what would be the consequences, what would be the humanitarian consequences if nuclear weapons are used. So remind people of that just basic knowledge piece again. Those meetings were used instrumentally to launch negotiations in the UN that eventually did produce a treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, or the Ban Treaty for short, which outlaws nuclear weapons, right? It calls for eventual nuclear disarmament. This is a treaty that was supported by a lot of the global South, a lot of the non-nuclear weapon states. The negotiations were boycotted by every state that has nuclear weapons and by all of the allies of the countries with nuclear weapons. So most of Europe, Japan, Australia, US, you know, Russia, China, et cetera, boycotted those talks and have been, for the most part, very critical of the ban treaty. So it's that treaty process to me looks like it's kind of stalemated. The non-nuclear weapon states made their bid. Right? We're frustrated by the slow pace of movement towards nuclear disarmament. We're going to try something new that is outside of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty context to try to establish a norm, to try to establish some social pressure on nuclear weapon states. And the nuclear weapon states got very defensive and sort of put up a big wall of resistance and didn't go along. Right? So it's hard to see what the pathway forward is for the ban treaty. But the humanitarian initiative, which paved the way for it, you know, you could do that without any end goal in mind in terms of it being something that should lead to a formal treaty outcome. Like, let's just bring state leaders, diplomats, politicians, thought leaders together and expose them to briefings about what happens if nuclear weapons are used, what are the scenarios that could create risks of nuclear war, maybe do this in ways that could translate into public educational activities. And I know that there are some efforts underway to continue this. Alexander Kement, a brilliant diplomat from Austria, who was one of the prime architects of the movement to negotiate the ban treaty, you know, is a supporter of maintaining the humanitarian initiative as a sort of independent side project. I don't know if that's really going to move forward or not, but that would be the kind of thing that would sort of, I think, reinstill the right mix of sort of fear and hope that would then, I think, indirectly buttress some of the institutional arrangements that provide global governance.
Thank you, Jeff. This has been a most interesting, wide-ranging podcast, and I want us to come to our last question. And I will refer to a podcast that we did with Michael Mandelbaum from Johns Hopkins, I think it was last year, where he warned us of the danger of a nuclearized Iran, which, you know, would trigger an arms race in the Middle East and possibly spilling over into other parts of the world, like Europe. Do you believe that what you call nuclear learning, you know, through the civil society organizations, popular culture that you speak about, is enough to detain new countries from building their own nuclear arsenals? And how might we reignite the civil society movements that work towards this, like the mass protests of earlier decades. I mean, one of the things that I find puzzling today is just this lack of interest. You know, this we seem to be concerned about this at some abstract level, but there is no counterpart at the level of civil society protests and so on. And then, if to conclude, you could also send a message to young people. A lot of the followers of the Global Governance Forum are young people in their 20s, in their 30s. How can we ask them not to lose hope?
Well, those are great questions. Let me start with the learning part. So the way I think about it is that we have many different bricks in the wall, if you will, right? Many different things that we put into place to try to erect barriers against nuclear war, right? And you need all the bricks. So there are many things that are necessary, but by themselves, they're not sufficient. So when I talk about learning, I really just mean I want people to be aware of what happens if nuclear weapons are used. I want people to have some sensibility about alternative scenarios that would create danger and what are the different ways in which things can go wrong. And I hope that people will draw some inferences from those pieces of knowledge that the existence of nuclear weapons requires people to tread very carefully, right? And that you want to do everything possible not to push your luck, not to get too close to sort of going over the cliff into a process that where you might lose control of events. That creates some inhibitions against nuclear dangers, but by itself, it's not enough, right? Things could still go wrong. You could still get a false alarm, an accident, a leader who's irrational, and so forth. So you need many other things as well. Hopefully, eventually, the best possible outcome would be nuclear disarmament, right? We get to a world where nuclear weapons are abolished in circumstances where there's sufficiently effective verification and alternative mechanisms for trying to resolve conflict. But I think we're a long way away from reaching global zero. So the question is, what do we do in the meantime? I would love to see young people more involved, more engaged, more active on this issue. Because of where I work institutionally, I do see some of it, right? We attract students to our own master's degree program who want to study these issues. The Center for Nonproliferation Studies based at my institute does all sorts of great educational and outreach activities starting as young as high school age, students, up through experienced diplomats and policy advisors. So education is one really important part of it. Give people the opportunity to take a class or a program of study and educate themselves and learn about these issues. Popular culture is another way I think that could be really valuable for motivating people. I mentioned at the beginning that I probably spent too much of my childhood reading sort of science fiction books set in a post-nuclear, post-apocalyptic world. Today, this might be a different kind of platform, social media sites that expose people to information, games that could be played online. But there's lots of ways in which you can let people know that this danger still exists and that there are ways in which they can organize and do something about it. The tricky issue for me, and I want to be clear that I'm not critical of young people at all, right? If I was 20 years old today and I was choosing to be politically active, there's a lot of very big problems out there, climate change, gun violence, racial justice. So I don't know where nuclear weapons would come out in my choice of issues to throw my energies into. But the danger, that as long as the weapons exist, as long as the know-how to make the weapons exists, the danger exists. And it's important for people to raise their voices and say that this is unacceptable, right? This would be the end of everything that we love and believe in, and we need to make our leaders, we need to hold their feet to the fire and make them act in ways that steer the world away from these dangers rather than bring us closer to these dangers.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.